Accession number 18035, Real One.
This is an interview with Sir Frederick Page on the 19th of September, 89.
Sir Frederick, could I begin by asking you how you came to join the aircraft industry and whether your family were engineers or you were the first in the family?
Well, I was born in 1917, and when 12 years old in 1929, I was already fascinated by aircraft, and I decided that by 35 I had to have full responsibility for an aircraft design organization. Why by 35? Well, because at that age, 12, that seemed the greatest age at which anyone could retain full mental and physical vigour. I think probably at 72 my ideas have changed slightly. But I don't think all that much. My colleagues will testify, I think, that I've always said that you must identify your potential leaders before they're 27, and see that they're trained and promoted to positions of real responsibility before they're 35. I became de facto chief engineer of English Electric's aircraft design department at 32, and was formally appointed a few days after my 33rd birthday, so I was, in American terms, slightly ahead of schedule. At the time of the original decision, circumstances were not propitious. My father had been a chauffeur and had been killed in the First World War before I was born, and we were desperately poor. I won't elaborate on that, except that it was very tough for my mother. I was fortunate in getting to a first-class semi-independent grammar school, Rutledge, as it was in those days, and it had an absolutely super headmaster, a chap called Varnish, quite one of the best men I've known.
What part of the country was this?
This was in Wimbledon, where I was born. And he was most helpful in many ways, as were all the staff there, and eventually I won a few scholarships and various organisations helped, and I went to Cambridge and at St Catherine's. Read mathematics for the first year, and then took part two engineering in 2 years. Ended up with a first class honours degree and scholar of CATS. Then it was a question of finding a job in the aircraft industry.
Did you study engineering with an aeronautical bias at that time, or was it just general
yes,
engineering?
There was another absolutely marvellous chap who was a tremendous help, and that was the Reverend Christopher Wadhams as a tutor in mathematics in the first year. In the specialised subjects like aeronautics, because at that time Cambridge had a general engineering degree covering the whole range of engineering, which was actually most useful in the aeronautical industry because it's got perhaps the broadest span of engineering technology of any type of engineering. But for the aeronautics part, Bennett Melville Jones was, otherwise known as Bones, was the professor of aeronautics, and a marvellous chap he was too, tremendous inspiration, and an excellent teacher as well as being a very good researcher. And of course you'll probably remember his work on the streamlined aeroplane, which eventually led to civil aircraft like the DC-3.
I never connected him, no.
Oh, yes. Mm. You'll find that he read a lecture to the Aeronautical Society. I think it was 27-ish on the streamlined aeroplane. Based on how he foresaw design should develop from the things that he was researching, boundary layer in particular. And anyway, the problem after Cambridge was to find a job in the aeronautical industry, and jobs generally were not particularly easily available in the pre-war years. The appointments board seemed to think that I was crazy to want to go into aeronautics, and thought sugar and oil were very much better bets financially.
You mean as a broker? You mean as a broker?
No. In those days, the thought was that you actually did something constructive rather than push money from A to B.
Rather than the opposite of...
So it was managing
what,
managing factories and things like that, you see. And developing the technology. But I decided in the end I'd better go and get myself a job, and I'd long admired the very elegant designs of Sydney Cam, and Kingston was fairly close to Wimbledon, so I went to see Sydney Cam. I wrote him and said, what about a job? And he was kind enough to offer an interview, and we talked about various things. And the question of salary came up. His thoughts was that for a first class graduate in mathematics and engineering who'd got to prove himself, £4 a week was a generous offer. I thought six would be a bit nearer the mark, and we compromised on five, with a review after 6 months. Salaries have changed a little since those days.
This was when? In 1937 or something?
38.
38.
Mm-hmm. 38. Incidentally, I had spent time in the vacations from Cambridge working in various places, one long vacation at the REE, and another long vacation in a motor car factory.
Which one?
The old British Thompson Works.
Oh, really?
At Rains Park, was it? Or New Malden? Somewhere near the old Sutton's Tested Seeds place. They've both gone now. But it was useful because one got one's hands dirty, and since the Sampson cars were all hand-built, you really learnt quite a lot about the whole thing and how it's put together. They also had a small aero engine, a nine-cylinder Sampson, and they were trying to uprate it, and after working on both the chassis and engines of the cars for a bit, I transferred to the test department of the this aero engine, which was good fun. We were trying to stop it use oil at a ridiculous rate.
And was it a radial?
A radial, nine-cylinder air-cooled radial. All very useful experience, and again, people were tremendously helpful. But the upshot of all this was that I joined Hawker Aircraft in the third quarter of 1938, and at that time the Typhoon was in the design phase, and I got involved on aileron and wing stressing.
The Hurricane had left the drawing office, presumably by then it was going through the shop.
Oh yes, yes. That, well, the Hurricane was already entering service at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved in a few odd jobs on the Hurricane, but not a great deal. The Typhoon story is quite a long one.
I managed to interview the late Philip Lucas back in 79, and I've got a lot of...
Oh, he was tremendous.
Stuff.
Tremendous.
I mean, the Tornado in particular,
yes,
that came before it, and the
yes,
misalliance with the Napier engine.
Yes.
And the tail problems and all.
Right.
That. Yeah.
The engine was a real problem, but of course those big engines were, because if you recall the Vulture engine, I thought was aptly named because it literally ate aeroplanes. There was a Tornado which preceded the Typhoon,
mm-hmm,
with a Vulture engine, and that combination was not very good at all, and you may recall that what ultimately became the Lancaster started off as the Manchester with two Vultures, which ate that aeroplane.
Anyhow, you were working on the Typhoon.
That's right, and the sort of things that I got involved in later, a lot with Philip Lucas, Bill Humble, and of course Roland Beaumont, and a number of the other test pilots and technical staff, was performance improvement, because the performance of the early production aircraft was not as good as it ought to have been. But by means of various tidying up, we did in fact clock it up to around about 425 miles an hour. And
specifically, what tidying up did you do? Presumably airframe modification and control,
yes,
modification, was it?
Well, airframe.
Mm.
But it was a whole, as with so many engineering things. It was a matter of attention to a hell of a lot of detail. Cleaning up the whole standard of finish was one of them. But the later versions, you recall, did have four-bladed propellers instead of three-bladed, and we substituted things like raked whip aerial for the old heavy, bulky mast for radio. Other things that we did were sort of fairing in the ejector exhausts and a number of things like that. Of course, the
radio
rear view canopy was a bit more of an aerodynamic job than the original canopy, as well as, of course,
the old car door.
Prime pubs. Oh yes, they were dreadful. They were dreadful. Why on earth that was done originally, I don't know.
And then didn't you put the radiators in the wing loops as well?
Or oh no, that was in that, the Tempest.
That was on the Tempest, yes, sorry.
But there was a lot of work done on the radiators. That was another bit of tidying up too, to try and get, well, reduce the drag as much as possible. Theoretically, you ought to be able to get a thrust from a radiator using the heat to accelerate the airstream, but of course you can never organise things
a sort of ramjet
as efficiently as you well, not quite there, but you can never organise things as efficiently as you would like. Mm. But at least we reduced the drag, so it was all that sort of thing.
And you were working under Sidney Cowan at this time, directly, were you?
Oh yes, very much so. He was a splendid chap to work for. Tremendously enthusiastic, and that enthusiasm conveyed itself to everybody. I mentioned detail earlier. He was a detail fanatic, and frequently used to come back from visits to the experimental shop, waving something which had taken his eye as a bad example of detailed design, saying in a loud voice, "Who the hell perpetrated this?" And you could see some poor unfortunate after a bit trying to pretend that he was invisible. Then there would be a short, sharp lesson in detailed design. And as a result of that attention to detail, one of the other jobs I had was trying to get a bit of weight out of the aeroplane and substituting aluminium and other materials for, as there was in those days, too much brass and steel knocking around. The other thing was, at the time of the, there was a whole series of accidents, not only due to engine failure, because the Sabre, as you rightly said earlier, was quite a troublesome bit of machinery with 24 sleeve valves and two crankshafts and so on. But the tail had a habit of coming off with unfortunately disastrous results. So we used an early version of the current methods, and this was developed at RAE, for plotting back wreckage traces. And from a number of these, you know, starting with a pattern of wreckage on the ground, it was quite clear that the cause of the accident was a failure at the tail end, because the tail units were always separated from the main breakup of the aeroplane. They came off first, in other words. A whole number of things were done to try to improve the accident rate. The view now is, I think, that it was primarily a case of flutter of the tailplane and elevator. But again, I'm not at all sure that there was just one simple cause. We did, in fact, do a whole lot of things because you couldn't go on with that sort of accident rate. It was bad enough facing the enemy, but for the guys who were flying, and you just had to do everything you could think of. So we did.
And they all operated.
Structural reinforcement. Again, this question of detail. Every single item in the rear end was crawled over, and quite a number of them were beefed up. And in some cases, the design changed. Incidentally, I ought to mention a very courageous act on the part of Philip Lucas early on in the Typhoon's history. Was one of the early problems was snaking, and in a high-speed dive, which in those days aircraft had to be dived to their specified terminal velocity, the aircraft started snaking laterally. And there was obviously some very severe damage in the rear fuselage. And I remember Philip Lucas saying from Langley experimental base, of course we were at Kingston, I think there's something here which you ought to have a look at. And so one or two of us went over there. I mean, I at that time was not a frightfully senior member of the design team, but somehow I got involved. And there was a great crack down each side of the fuselage. The rear fuselage was, the tail end was holding on by means of two fairly small bits of structure, top and bottom, and you could literally see daylight through the fuselage where it had torn on both sides under the forces involved in this severe lateral movement. But somehow he brought it back and landed it. And I think that was absolutely marvellous airmanship. I think he was awarded a medal for that. Quite rightly.
And needless to say, I got not a mention out of Philip himself about this.
That's typical. You wouldn't.
Mm.
But that was really fantastic. But as a result, we knew what happened, and it was cured by the simple business of modifying the balance of the rudder, because it was just that the balance of the rudder was wrong. A bit of reduction of the horn balance and strip, two strips of cord down the trailing edge, fixed.
So it was a dangerous harmonic that was building up in certain flight conditions, was it?
Well,
that really sort of started tearing the structure to pieces at the back. When you say the horn balance, was it?
No, it was just that. It's a bit difficult to explain without getting too technical about it. It's a question of the response of the rudder to sideslip and to radar deflection. If you get the aerodynamic coefficients controlling those two responses wrong, you can get the rudder wagging the aeroplane fairly severely. You know, we ultimately had a touch of the same sort of thing in Canberra, but only very slightly, and it just didn't do any damage at all. So, but one of the main problems of the Typhoon was that although it was an immensely rugged aeroplane, and once the problems got sorted out, did an absolutely magnificent job as a tank buster, train busting and so on, it was limited performance-wise in sort of air-to-air combat at anywhere other than low levels. It was very good at low. It was surprisingly good at low level, but at the higher levels it was limited by the very thing that made it ideal as a load carrier and tank buster, that is a 19% thick route section. The NPL had sold this to Sydney on the basis that it was aerodynamically acceptable. Well, for a fighter aircraft that wanted performance at high altitude, it just wasn't. And what's more, it was an old-fashioned section as well, an old NACA section, which made matters worse. So one of the things we tackled, and this was a thing with which I was particularly concerned, was wing section development. And we married some of the very early theories of Theodorsen to the work being done by John Stack in the NACA 4-inch supersonic tunnel at Langley. John Stack was doing the work.
Langley in the States.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Langley in the States, sorry. Mm-hmm. Not Langley.
No.
The Hawker Langley near Slough. John Stack was doing this work in aid of the development of propeller sections. The calculations were appallingly difficult because one didn't have digital computers. The equations involved were was known as ill-conditioned, and they had to be tackled by working to an enormous number of decimal places on a mixture of mechanical Adler desk machines and Fuller slide rule. But fortunately, one of the chaps who helped was Frank Lloyd, an ex-Indian army officer. And he was a marvellously reliable chap on those sort of calculations. And eventually we married up, worked quite well. We developed a mathematically designed section. And we aimed to get a pressure distribution which would delay the onset of compressibility effects, because you could, the old section that was used on the Typhoon had an appalling pressure peak which induced shock waves at a very early stage, and consequently at high speeds, you just had to wait for the aircraft to recover itself. When in a very high-speed dive, it did so automatically as you reached lower altitudes and therefore lower Mach numbers. The upshot of this was we ended up with a wing section with the maximum thickness a good deal smaller. The thing we aimed for on the Tempest was an average thickness of about 11%. The maximum thickness was around about 12.5%, but it tapered in thickness chord ratio out to the tip. And the position of the maximum thickness of the wing section was nearer 40% than the conventional, the then conventional 30%.